So the CO of the training squadron, a man named McDonald, I think, asked me if I wouldn't take another P-47 and go up and find this kid and bring him back and get him down on the ground again. Now, we knew where he was, so that wasn't a problem, and the kid with the canopy open could see out the sides, sort of. Tell the truth, I don't know how well he could see, not too damn well. Anyway, I had no trouble. I took off, and I had no trouble finding him, all right, and he tacked onto my wing. He could look out the side, all right, in fly formation, and I talked to him, and I said, now, look, they've cleared the field, and I am going to just fly off of your wing. You stay off. You just fly off my wingtip off to one side, and I'm going to bring you in, and you do just what I tell you when I tell you. But I am going to be flying alongside the runway while you are right over the runway. So the last little bit of this landing operation you're going to have to do on your own. But I'll get you into position, and all you have to do is just finish the landing, which shouldn't have been too difficult because he isn't used to being able to see straight ahead at that point anyway. And it did work out pretty well. We came around, and I put down my landing gear, and he put down his, and then I put down my flaps, and he put down his, and I maintained my position right along beside him and kept the airspeed about what his ought to have been. And I just flew alongside and brought him in right over the runway and down almost to the ground. And then I said, okay, you're on your own, land it. And I pulled up my gear and went on off, and he landed the airplane all right. He didn't have any problem with it, which was a little bit of a surprise to me because no matter how you look at it, that's kind of tricky business. But high point of that episode happened later that day at lunch. Evidently, the episode occurred in the morning because at lunch I was sitting at a big table in the mess hall with a bunch of people, including a bunch of trainees. And there was this one that I didn't even know. I didn't know who he was. Anyway, and it became obvious that that he didn't know who I was either. Because he was sitting there at the table telling all these other trainees about this episode and how Captain Dilworth had saved his life. And he was describing this thing and describing me in glowing terms. And, of course, I was not only pleased about that, but I was amused at the fact that he didn't know that I was sitting right there across the table from him. And some of the people at the table knew who I was, some didn't. And those who did were grinning from ear to ear, as I was, but nobody said anything until he'd been allowed to tell his little story. I may or may not have mentioned one time when I was at Bradley Field, I got another bout or spell or attack or whatever you call it of malaria and was in the hospital for a week or so. And when I got out of the hospital, I still wasn't ready to fly, and I asked Captain McDonald if I could take a couple of days off, and he said I could. So I immediately drove up to Westover to Aunt Toby's to visit for a day or two. But before I left, I stole a smoke bomb from someplace, and I told my friend Hollis, I said, now here's where this place is, and you'll have trouble locating it because it's sort of in the forest in a way, in the fields and the country. You come up there and you fly around, and when I see you, I'm going to set off this smoke bomb, and you'll know exactly where it is, and then you can buzz the house and so on. Well, he did. We were up there in the middle of the morning. These four P-47s came flying over, and I set off the smoke bomb, which just poured out a great cloud of smoke. And Hollis saw it right away, and they came zooming in over on Toby's house several times and flew away, much to my delight, and to the neighbor's edification and amazement. Somebody in the 1st Air Force had a had a, I don't know who ran this thing, but it was a unit that would vector fighters onto enemy aircraft. Because, remember, we were at war and the East Coast was protected by anti-aircraft guns and also by airplanes. Just what airplanes, I don't know, but there must have been some. What I'm saying is that the airplanes we had at Bradley Field, they may have had guns in them. I'm not sure that they did, but they certainly didn't carry any ammunition. So if some airplanes were equipped to attack German bombers, I don't know where they were. But anyway, that doesn't matter. The fact is that they had this setup. And to keep in training, they had a airplane. I think it was the same airplane that Colonel, kind of airplane that Colonel Massey wrecked, a Curtiss something or other. Oh, something for observation. It's a big old cumbersome thing. A single engine, but it was big and cumbersome anyway. And so they used to fly that airplane around, and then they would, when they would see fighters from Bradley Field or Providence, Rhode Island, or wherever they happened to be around, they'd pick them up on radar. They would ask them, would you be willing to do a vector, or whatever they called it? And they meant they wanted to direct us towards this other airplane and perfect their technique at this process. And of course, normally, if we could, we were only too happy to take part in such a thing. So on this particular occasion, I have in mind, I was up flying with a couple of trainees, and these people called me and said, would you like to work a vector problem? And I said, yes, sure, we'd be glad to. So they said, steer a course of so-and-so, and then every now and then they'd call you up and say, tell us what altitude we were supposed to go to and what course we were supposed to fly. And if you did what they told you, invariably you would find yourself flying head-on into this Curtiss observation plane that they had messing around there. And on this occasion, we did that, and they vectored us in there, and we just zipped on by him and went on back to the field and landed. We had just landed and taxied in and shut off the engine, and I was still in the cockpit filling out my Form 1. The Form 1, incidentally, is a basic Air Corps form, and it's still used, probably not much changed even. But you put in your time of takeoff and your time of landing and what kind of mission you were on, and if it was cross-country, you went from where to where. And you also used it to report any malfunctions in the airplane. So the first thing you did when you landed and taxied in, shut off the engine, was to fill out the Form 1. That was basic. Always did that, even in New Guinea, no matter where you were. And so I was filling out the Form 1, and the first thing I knew, this major, unknown to me, I mean, I don't know who he was, didn't know who he was, climbed up on the wing, and he said, well, Captain, he said, having a little fun, were you? And I said, I don't know what you mean, sir. And he said, well, weren't you buzzing that observation plane? And I said, no, sir, we're not. And he said, well, what were you doing then? And I said, we were vectored to it. And he said, you were what? And I said, we were vectored to it. We often work those vector problems for fighter control. And they asked us if we wanted to do it, and we did it. And just about that time, he stood there eyeing me, and there was a lieutenant colonel standing down on the ground below, and I heard him say, give him hell, Major. And I looked down there to see old Paul Slocum, of all people. And, of course, Paul, it was an old 7th Fighter Squadron man. We had come home together. We had been to Hillsgrove together. So I didn't take the major's complaints very seriously. Well, when the major looked down there and saw Paul, and I guess he did, and saw that Paul and I knew each other, why, he sort of dropped this thing. And it had been an honest mistake. He really did think we were doing something we weren't supposed to do. And I guess he became convinced that I was telling the truth. And so he let go of the problem. In fact, we went and had lunch together. And Paul and he were both, they were both with the flying safety people at Mitchell Field, and had come up on a routine inspection trip, and it happened to run on us in the middle of our interception problem. Anyway, the major's name was John, shoot, can't think of his last name, John somebody. Anyway, he was a man I came to know very well in the course of time. And anyway, that was the end of that particular episode, but it was important because it got me known by somebody down at First Fighter Command besides Paul Slocum. And as I said, Paul and John were both at this time in the flying safety section down at Mitchell Field at 1st Fighter Command headquarters. And all my reports, accident reports, went straight into their desks. So they knew my name. And I took them around the base and showed them what we were doing and all that sort of stuff. And they left towards the end of the afternoon. But the upshot was that sometime later, when Paul Slocum was transferred out of the flying safety section at 1st Fighter Command and into the operations and training section, they then had a vacancy, and they chose me to come down there and fill the vacancy because I was somebody that... that they already knew, I suppose. One time while I was at Bradley Field, I took that AT-6 in which I had flown Jack around and flew down to Philadelphia for a weekend to visit Father, who was living with Uncle John and Aunt Jane. I had to land at the Naval Air Station there in Philadelphia because there wasn't any Air Force base near. And I spent a nice weekend there. I think it was just one night probably or something. But I remember that Uncle John and Aunt Jane were rather critical of my, as they thought, wasting government gasoline by taking what they looked upon as a pleasure trip. But the fact of the matter was, of course, that pilots were always encouraged to do this sort of thing, to keep their hand in into navigation and so on, and it was a reasonable thing, but they saw it just as a sort of lark of some kind, and something reprehensible, I believe. When I went out to Muston Field, which was the Navy base there, there was a sailor who wanted a ride back to, I can't remember the name of it, something point. Anyway, it was a Navy base in Rhode Island. The trouble with flying Air Force people flying in and out of Navy bases is that we weren't able to communicate with them by radio. So you would have to circle the field and with your landing gear down until somebody in the tower noticed you, and then they would give you a green light from the tower, and you could go ahead and land. And that's what I'd had to do at Muston. When before I left, I phoned the tower and told them that I was going to be leaving in 10 minutes or something, and would they, when I started the engine, would they give me a green light when it was ready to taxi? And all that worked out very well. Well, this sailor wanted a ride. Well, I wasn't going to take him back to wherever it was he wanted to go, but I told him I'd take him to Bradley Field and see that he got on a train, and that seemed to me good enough. And he had a damn footlocker with him, and oddly enough, the baggage compartment on an AT-6 was not very large, and I certainly didn't think it was large enough to hold a footlocker, but it did. He slipped it in there with no trouble, and I flew him back to Bradley and then drove him down to the train station, put him on a train. I guess he got it back all right. There was another occasion, and whether this happened later or while I was at Bradley Field, I'm not sure, but I think while I was at Bradley Field, I was sent down to a base in Wilmington, North Carolina, to pick up a P-47 and ferry it back up to Bradley Field. And First Air Force had a C-47, which made a sort of round-robin tour of all their bases, perhaps not every day, but almost every day, to carry people who had occasion on official business to go from one of the bases to the other, and also there was a good deal of official mail and stuff like that. And so I got on the C-47, which took me down to Wilmington, and we stopped here and stopped at there, stopped at Dover and stopped at Andrews and stopped at Richmond and God, I don't know where, and it was hot as hell. I remember that. And one occasion, one of the passengers got sick and threw up all over the floor. That was nasty. Incidentally, all those C-47s, both in New Guinea and in the U.S., they were always described as having bucket seats, and I believe that would give a false impression of what those seats were like. Now, what they had was nothing but a long aluminum shelf divided into parts, which ran down each side of the airplane right under the windows. And this shelf had legs that folded down, and you could fold the legs up and fold the shelf down against the side, so there was nothing there. It was all clear for cargo space. But when the shelves were lifted up and the legs lowered, why, you just sat on this aluminum shelf, and it had indentations for your butt. But that was all. And another thing they all shared in common, was the fact that the windows down both sides all had holes in them lined with a rubber grommet sort of thing. And those holes were intended so that if you had troops in there who had occasion to fire their rifles, they could stick their rifles out through those holes. They all always had that, all those C-47s. I never rode in one that didn't. But as for the seats, they did have a seat belt for each occupant, but they were just hard aluminum things. You were just sitting on an aluminum shelf. That's all you were sitting on. They had no sides, or you just crammed in there pretty close together. They weren't comfortable at all. Well, I got away from my story. I went down to Wilmington and picked up this airplane, which was practically new. And decided that I wouldn't go straight home. I could have flown probably nonstop right back up to Bradley from Wilmington. I'm certain I could. But I decided that I didn't see any great rush about this, and that I would land at Roanoke and spend the night with Anna and Grace. And I did that. And the same thing happened at Roanoke Airport as it did other places where you couldn't communicate with the tower. I just circled the field with the gear down till they gave me a green light. That's an indication to the tower you want to land. And they gave me a green light, and I missed the first approach. At least I came in, I thought, too fast, and the runways weren't all that long, and I wasn't willing to take a chance on it, and so I went around and landed there and taxied up near the tower, wherever they directed me, and left the airplane and called Grace and said I was there and could I spend the night and could she come get me. And of course, gas was scarce in those days, and was rationed, that is, And so on the way back to the house from the airport, I gave her one of my coupons so she was able to get some more gas. And I spent the night there and had a very pleasant time. And the next morning, she and Anna and David drove me out to the airport, and I got in my airplane and warmed it up and so forth, and then shut off the engine, and Anna wanted to look inside, and David wanted to look inside, and Grace did, so they all climbed up on the wing and looked in and got a good view. And then I went up and telephoned the control tower and told them I was ready to take off, and would they give me, what runway were they using, would they give me a green light when they were ready for me to taxi, and they did all that, and I took off and flew on up to Bradley Field without further incident, though I do think that I remember I went over Anoka and Linwood and the Wilson's house and all that stuff on the way, so I had all day to mess around. And I remember, too, that the visibility was very poor, and it wasn't cloudy, it wasn't a cloud in the sky, it was just extremely hazy, and you couldn't see very well at all, but I saw well enough to find Port Republic and Linwood and so forth. There was a similar sort of flight like that I made once, and I don't remember when that happened either, but I had to fly a P-47 from, I'll tell you what it was when I was at Mitchell Field. I think I'll tell about it now because I'm sure to forget it if I put it off. But I had gone down on an inspection flight to Walterboro, South Carolina, where we had a colored training unit. And so on my way back, I thought, I will land at Shaw Field, by God. Be like coming home again. I haven't been there since I was in basic flying school. And at that time, Shaw Field was still a basic flying school. And like some other places, I couldn't communicate with the tower. And I did the usual thing, flew around. They gave me a green light, and I landed. And this was late in the morning, and I decided I would stay there and have lunch, the officers' club, and then fly the rest of the way back that afternoon. But lo and behold, when I went back out to the airplane, my goodness, those people, somebody, the operations officer, somebody had taken it upon himself to put an armed guard on this airplane, and he was standing there at attention with his rifle and all. There was an aviation cadet who had come out to see the P-47, and he had more nerve than most of them. He went up right up there and was just standing around looking at it, and I said, do you want to see the inside? And I said, come on, get up there. So I had him, I showed him how to climb up on the wing and get in, and he sat in there, and I showed him what was what. He was immensely delighted by all this, and I'm sure that he had the best story of the day to tell his buddies, because he was the only one there that got to sit in the P-47 and so on. And anyway, that's the end of that story. I took off and went on back to Mitchell Field, but it was a rather pleasant episode, and I always remembered it with pleasure, mainly because flying a P-47 into a place like that, you are an automatic hero and big shot, and nobody minds that. At least I didn't. Well, as I said, Paul Slocum got transferred, and First Fighter Command issued orders to Bradley Field to issue orders to me, transferring me down to Mitchell Field. And this took place on or about May the 1st, 1945, and it was only a day or so after VE Day in Europe. And I had a radio in the car, and I remember listening all the way down avidly to all these surrender proceedings which were going on and being broadcast on the radio, and it was all quite fascinating. And so I got down to Mitchell Field and reported in, and I was put in this flying safety section, which consisted of three people. John, whatever his name was, I wish I could think of his name, but I can't. and a Weck, who was also a captain, Arlene somebody. Arlene Francis? I don't know. Arlene, anyway, and me, the three of us. And we were in charge of processing accident reports for the entire 1st Fighter Command. And we put out a weekly little bulletin. It was a thing with pictures in it, and crash pictures, and descriptions of all the crashes that had... accidents, that is, not crashes necessarily. Accidents that had taken place in the 1st Fighter Command during that week, with a description of them and who took part and what happened, and a sort of critique as to what was what had been done wrong and what steps were taken to see that it didn't happen again. Periodically, we were supposed to fly to all the different bases that we had and review the safety procedures that were being used there, and make criticisms if there were any, and pay compliments if there were any. And it was a sort of a procedure, a set procedure. You'd go there and report in, and you always had to report to the base commander himself. That was a rigid matter of protocol. You would never visit a base without reporting first to the commanding officer of the base itself. And sometimes he didn't want to see you. He knew what you were there for and all, but generally they did. Generally they would always ask you to come in, and they were invariably very nice to you, and say, I want you to, almost always would say, I want you to come see me, but just before you leave, and I want you to tell me what you found out, and tell me anything you think I ought to know. And so you would do that. And your key liaison man, of course, was always the flying safety officer on the base. These things were kind of pleasant. And I remember on one occasion deciding that I wanted to go to Harrisonburg, so I cooked up the scheme to inspect the base at Richmond. And it was on a Saturday, and the captain, who was the flying safety officer, I'm sure had better things to do on Saturday. And I'm sure he was quite delighted when... After he had spent about an hour showing me around, I told him that was fine, and that I was going to go to Harrisonburg. So he was free to go his own way, and I jumped on a bus or something. I remember walking in on the family in the middle of supper. I suppose it was supper, but it was totally unexpected. I spent the night, took the bus back to Richmond the next day, and went on back to Mitchell Field. Mitchell Field was a base unlike any I had ever been on before, by which I mean to say unlike any on which I had been assigned for permanent duty. Of course, I'd been to Mitchell Field itself before, but the thing was that the bases I had been on previously were all new and hastily assembled things. Whereas Mitchell Field was an old, established base, been around for many years, and the buildings were, for the most part, brick, and the streets were all paved, and there were sidewalks and shrubbery and green grass, and it was all a very staid and comfortable thing. And Fifth Fighter Command at that time was run by a general by the name of Hawkins, and he was known affectionately by those who were high-ranking enough to do so as Shorty, because he was probably only 5'6" or something, and people called him Shorty Hawkins. He was a brigadier general. But... He was a very nice man. He was dignified, but he had quite a sense of humor. And he knew when to be stern and strict, and he knew when to laugh and look the other way. And he told a story once about when he had been stationed at some place in North Africa. And he was down on the flight line, and he said he heard the most god-awful ruckus going on some distance down the flight line. And he sent to find out what it was all about. And his messenger came back and said, it's General Patton raising hell with somebody. And somebody said, well, General Hawkins, what did you do? And he said, I didn't do anything. I was scared. Funny thing, I ran into General Hawkins one day after the war. I was in Washington for some reason, walking down the street, and there was General Hawkins in uniform, looking in the store window, and we had a little chat. He was later killed in a landslide, of all things, in South America. He had been assigned to Peru or someplace, the embassy.